We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program of sorts we had him on a couple of times back in the Air America days. Wayne Barrett, he was a reporter for the Village Voice for, I believe it was 37 years. He has the author of 5 books, including 2 on Rudy Giuliani and was an adjunct professor at Columbia Graduate School of Journalism for years. Wayne, great to have you on. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you again, Sam.
So, Wayne, I mean, I think the last time we talked was probably about Giuliani. But let me ask you this. I mean, did you your book now, Trump Deals and Downfall, and it's been reissued on Amazon as an ebook. But the original now is like I'm hearing stories of like this is like a this is like World Series tickets with scalping of your book.
That's right. I mean, my wife's friend had a book club, and everybody bought the book before the ebook was issued, and now it's called, by the way, Trump, the Greatest Show on Earth, the Deals, the Downfall, and the Reinvention. Lots of words for a title, but that's what it's called now. But at any rate, people at the book party from the book club had paid up to $400 for it, so it's a hot item, a lot hotter than it was when it came out in 1991, December of 1991.
So let me ask you this. I mean, I want to definitely cover sort of the early deals, and much of what I know about Trump I know from your writing. But in 2012, let's just start here. In 2012, he had he sort of flirted with a run. He never sort of officially declared, but he was certainly in that sort of, flying a balloon stage. And I think you'd written a piece back at that time sort of outlining why he didn't run after all those years revisiting Trump. Give me a sense of why you didn't run then and why you think he did this time around.
Well, actually, you know, he was flirting with it in 2011 for the 2012 race. And I did a piece. I was then at the Daily Beast and did a piece at Dina Brown's urging that, you know, sort of went back to the old days and looked at some of the new issues that would have, I thought, exploded his candidacy. Now we learned that apparently nothing can explode your candidacy in a Republican primary, at least. But I thought that, you know, I had written in the book about 25 or so different mob associations that he had in his early business life. So I looked at some of the newer ones in his more current business life in that 2011 piece. And, you know, he wrote a letter to Tina at the time urging her not to publish me, but she went right ahead and she was very supportive of the piece. But by the time I got it done, he had pulled out. I started working on it a month or two before he pulled out, but it was a brief flirtation. And the theory of my piece was that there were so many fresh scandals about him in terms of his business relationship. I looked primarily at the Trump Soho in Manhattan and at a Fort Lauderdale project in which a swarm of mob or criminal guys were involved. And I just detailed the relationships, the partnerships that he had in those two projects, which were pretty alarming, and how the depositors who were buying units in these apartments had essentially been defrauded. And so I thought issues like that would haunt the presidential candidate, and I thought it was the reason why he dropped out of the race. Well, we've now learned that, you know, you can add to the list and throw virtually anything at him, and it doesn't seem to affect his race-based candidacy in Republican primaries. It doesn't seem to matter what he's done. the facts aside, so long as he conveys the race-based message that he's conveyed his core constituency within Republican primaries. I doubt that it'll be the same in a general, but his core constituency is really only interested in that core message.
You know, I got to say that's why I'm talking to you now, because my theory has always been that up to now, Trump's candidacy has been less about Trump and more about the Republican Party. And as we go into the general election, where he's going to have to present himself to what I refer to as normal people, as opposed to the Republican primary voter, that this type of stuff is actually going to have some resonance. Now, hope springs eternal, because what you outline in that piece.
It's not just hope, Sam. We are reality-based, and, this is still the same country that re-elected Barack Obama in 2012 with a very substantial majority, and so it's not just a matter of hope. We would have to become another country than the one that elected Barack Obama twice, especially after 4 years of relentless Republican barrage against him in 2012, and I think we'd have to be a different country to do essentially the opposite thing and elect Donald Trump. So to me, it's not just a hope. It's a very reasonable premise.
Yes, I would agree with that. I would agree with that as well, frankly. And but let's nevertheless, I think we can strengthen that premise in making sure that the American people, or at least the ones that can hear us right now, have full disclosure about what Donald's about. So let's go back in time. One of the things that I know that you wrote about extensively was his early deals, not just his associations, but there was one dynamic that I know that you really have taken issue with, was his claim that the only way his dad helped him, as if this wasn't enough, was to give him $1 million loan. But in fact, tell us what his relationship was, what his dad's relationship was to Trump's early success.
Well, just imagine it. He was in his 20s or early 30s when he did all of his first deals. I actually had his tax returns for some of those period. I cite them in the book. He had a very small income. The book will tell you the dollar amount, but I had his tax returns. They had to be filed with the Casino Control Commission, and so I got them in the course of reporting the book. And, there's absolutely no way that a bank would have financed the giant projects that launched his career, the acquisition of the Commodore Hotel and the transformation of it into the Grand Hyatt, the acquisition of the sites at maybe the most expensive location in America, right there at on Fifth Avenue in the Central Park for Trump Tower, which he began the acquisition of that in the late 70s when he was a kid developer. Well, all of these things, even down to Trump Plaza, his first casino in the early 80s down in Atlantic City, Fred Trump signed all the loan documents. Fred Trump introduced Donald to his relationship banker, Conrad Stevenson, at the Chase Manhattan, and brought him to Equitable Life, which also had financed a Fred Trump project. So just, it's axiomatic that these projects would not have been funded if Donald Trump was standing there alone. Fred Trump, I tell the tale of when he bought the first parcels down in Atlantic City, and Fred Trump was opposed to Donald going to Atlantic City and doing casinos, but they ride down together in the limousine to sign the closing documents on the initial properties with all of these mob lawyers and mob guys that he was buying them from on the boardwalk. And, they think they finished the closing, and Fred and Donald, go out to the limo out in front, and they call out the window because Fred failed to sign something. They're not going to close the deal unless Fred comes back up and signs it. So, just from a financing standpoint, the political connections that made the whole thing possible with the Beam administration, which was then, Abe Beam was then the mayor of the city of New York, and Hugh Carey was the governor. Both of those political associations were created by Fred Trump, and, you know, he opened the doors to everything. You know, Donald's first office in Manhattan, the rent was paid for by Fred Trump's corporation. There was absolutely nothing that Donald did in those days, in those early days of his career, that wasn't, whether the financing, the political connections, all of it was directly attributable to Fred. And Fred made it all possible. Any attempt to diminish his role or to success or to suggest that he was a self-made man, it's just totally contrary to fact.
Yeah, I mean, from the way that you portray him, at least early on, he definitely seemed to have some skill or at least some attention to detail in terms of the building projects. But none of these things would have happened had it not he not been basically. The financing and the political deals, particularly in the context of New York real estate, are really you could probably find several hundred or thousand people who could walk in and fulfill the role that that Donald did if he had his dad's backing.
Well, you know, even the properties themselves, the first two properties, the West Side Yards and the Commodore Hotel, were both owned by Penn Central. And Penn Central, Philadelphia-based railroad company, was in bankruptcy. And they had to get options, by they I mean Fred and Donald, had to get options from approved by the courts from Penn Central. And Fred was extremely instrumental in that. In fact, I tell the tale in the book about how the representative of Penn Central went before they decided to give Donald the options, came to New York, and who did he meet with but Fred Trump? And where did they go? They got in the limo and rode down to City Hall, and there's Abe Beam standing on the steps of City Hall to greet them and tell them, tell Penn Central, which was, you know, wanted the option to actually lead to a project where they wouldn't get their payoff. The mayor of the city of New York says to his dear friend Fred, who came from the same political club, the Madison Club in Brooklyn. I mean, just a club of a couple hundred people. They were extremely close. Abe Beam says, anything that the Trumps want, I'll give them. Now, if Fred had tried to do the project himself, it probably would have been a scandal, because Fred Trump had a long history of scandal, the FHA scandals he was implicated in, the state Mitchell Lama scandals. The State Investigations Commission did a report expressly, I mean, it was an 80-page report about Fred Trump and Bunny Lindenbaum, his lawyer, and how they had ripped off the state Mitchell Lama program. So if Fred tried to do the Grand Hyatt himself, it would and get all these benefits that were crafted expressly for this hotel project, get all these benefits from the Beam and Carey administrations, it might have been blocked. It would have been such a scandal. So Donald was in some ways this glamour boy cover for Fred in pulling off this initial deal.
And I should just remind people who don't know New York history, Abe Beam was the mayor of New York from 74 to 77, Democratic mayor from that time. And Fred Trump was big in that whole that Democratic machine coming out of Brooklyn, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I interviewed Joe Sharkey at one point in the course of reporting on the book, and he was the county leader in the 50s, but he went way back to the 30s as a power in the Brooklyn Democratic machine. And when I interviewed him, he was either late 80s or early 90s. And, he said that, you know, Fred put the phone lines in his office, that Fred, you know, paid for the furniture in his office as county leader. Fred was the financier in many respects of the Brooklyn Democratic machine, which was then the most powerful political organization in the state. I said to Sharkey, when did you first see Fred Trump at the FHA, and Sharkey said to me, I went down to Roosevelt's inaugural, and after the inaugural, I went over to the FHA, and Fred was already there. Fred was on the ground floor of every subsidy program he could suck money out of. He was on the ground floor of every... He built 20,000 units, and not one of them wasn't in some way subsidized by a state or a federal program. So,
and that sounds like something that like Donald Trump definitely learned, right? I mean, so when he talks about giving money to Hillary Clinton and to giving money to all politicians, that is a huge lesson, it sounds like, he learned from his father.
Well, his father and he. They're not just donors, and Fred was a big donor himself. They were, you know, networkers. They hired the right people. You know, Mario Cuomo's governor. Donald hires Andrew Cuomo to be his lawyer. Mm. You know, it's pretty obvious. And he wasn't the only developer that did it, but he was one of the first to do it. And, you know, or take Ed Koch, who he had a very up-and-down relationship with. Alan Schwartz was Ed Koch's old law partner. He became the city's top attorney when Koch was mayor. And when he left, who's one of the first clients to hire him? Donald Trump. You know, you could go down the list. The Hyatt Project, he hires Louise Sunshine, who was the chief fundraiser for Hugh Carey, and puts her on his personal staff. So it wasn't just contributions. They played the game. You know, Stanley Friedman was the deputy mayor under Abe Beame, who steered all of the details of the public benefits for the Hyatt through the administration. On December 31st, 1977, the last day of the Beame administration, he was still steering major benefits to Trump, and the next day walked in and became a partner to Roy Cohn, who was Donald's primary personal attorney. Mm. So, you know, it's just a series of relationships like that where they manipulated the political process. They were consummate state capitalists who manipulated both father and son.
What we're talking about is what we call today crony capitalism on a national level, right? I mean, that's basically the dynamic. And what's also interesting to me is that he tried to do the same thing with you on some level. And, you know, I guess what I'm, suggesting is that, you know, once these dynamics exist, once this is the way that they've learned that they've had their success, it probably continues. Because I know there was a story like when you guys were almost sort of starting out in your own professions, you did not have the same sort of patron that, that Donald seems to have had. But, you know, when
I had a better one, Jack Newfield.
Well, there you go. And but I guess my point is this, is like when Donald Trump sits there and sort of says to you, like, you know, I've broken other reporters who reported, you know, unfavorably about me. And, you know, you should be living in a different part of town. I got a lot of apartments. That dynamic, you know, we saw one thing where he hired a guy from Breitbart, for instance, as a consultant. We see people like Sarah Palin coming out of the woodwork to endorse him. I have a sense, without having, dug much deeper, that the dynamics that were formed in New York probably continue to this day, just different players.
Yeah, I think Donald believes he can seduce and compromise anyone. He tried to compromise me in the 70s when I was writing the first really critical pieces about him in his life. And he offered me an apartment. And the book is filled with examples of people who got apartments from him who were engaged in one form or another on the other side of the table. I mentioned Conrad Stevenson from Chase Bank, who was the relationship banker. Well, I discovered when I did the book that he had an apartment on a discount in Trump Park, which was clearly a conflict because he was financing one project after another and winds up with an apartment on a discount. So he always used apartments as a form of leverage as a weapon in his arsenal to compromise people. There are numerous examples of it in the book. And so it's consistent with that, that as this rookie that he was and I was in the 70s when we first met, you know, he offered me one.
Let's talk about the DOJ suit, because I think this is an example of in its very best light, indication of Donald Trump's awareness of the value of race, I guess, to put it very nicely. Tell us about that DOJ suit.
Well, this starts way back in 73 when he was, you know, he was really just starting out, and he was working for Fred in Brooklyn in the Avenue Z offices of Fred's company. And the Department of Justice in the Nixon administration, mind you, brings a lawsuit, a racial discrimination lawsuit against the Trump Organization, and for excluding blacks and Latinos from most of their apartment complexes. And Roy Cohn, the notorious Joe McCarthy lawyer who became so attached to Donald over the course of his early career, represented Donald and Fred in this case. And, you know, it's sort of typical of Roy then and Donald now. The defense was instead just an attack on the federal prosecutors who brought the case, and this was a civil lawsuit, but, you know, questioning their motives, calling them the Gestapo, even though they were Jewish, and just trying every – the judge threw out this countersuit that Roy filed. Donald claimed in the course of the lawsuit that he had nothing to do with the rental of the apartments, but as I pointed out in the book and as I pointed out in stories in the 70s, he in fact sought a real estate broker's license from the New York Secretary of State at the same time and had to file a sworn document saying that he said that he was in charge of the rental of all of the Trump Organization's apartments, and at the same time in sworn documents in federal court, he was claiming he had nothing to do with it. So, you know, early audacity, you know.
Well, tell us and, how the way that they, I mean, exactly what it was the DOJ was saying that they were doing in terms of excluding blacks and Latinos from their housing units.
Well, they had a color-coded system of files, where when an applicant came in and was black, it went into a certain color folder. When someone came in that had a Latino name, it went into another kind of folder. And when white applicants came in, it went into another kind of folder. And some of the folders were never looked at again. And so they systematically discriminated. The case also, as a minor part of the case, pointed out that they basically didn't employ anybody who was black or Latin, or very few. And so there was also, when the Trump Organization finally signed a consent decree, it also dealt with employment practices, which, by the way, they signed it and then violated it. They had to go back into federal court with it in the late 70s, in which the consent decree was finally enforced in some way. But they were not in compliance with it after a couple of years after initially signing it. So it was, you know, and Donald's attitude, he would talk about this publicly, and Roy would do it in the case, which was to equate blacks and Latinos with welfare recipients and just say their defense was they were trying to keep welfare recipients who couldn't afford to live in a Trump building, not that they're for rich people, but they, as welfare recipients, they just equated it and say we're trying to keep welfare recipients out and in the interest of our tenants. And, you know, so that was the line of defense, and it was, you know, an absurd defense, but that was what they offered.
You know, it's interesting because it's the defense is pretty offensive in and of itself, aside from it being, you know, we're just trying to keep out welfare recipients. I mean, it sort of reminds me a little bit of like of that dynamic where Trump is like, my dad just gave me $1 million loan, where the real story is that, in fact, my dad made every deal at the beginning of my career, you know, by backing everything up. I mean, do you find that in the course of your reporting then, and when you look back into it last cycle, I mean, is this a pattern? I mean, has he figured out some dynamic here where it's like, I can get away with a murder if I cop to assault?
Well, you know, it's almost axiomatic. I would think that even most Republicans believe, I'm talking about just voters, believe that he has a very remote connection to the truth. And, you know, there's some people that doesn't bother, so long as, you know, white people are going to be back running the show again in a big and flashy way. And, you know, I think, yeah, these stories, look, I wrote in that very first series in the 70s that I did on him, and I asked him about it before I wrote it. You know, he had this chicken or egg issue on his very first project, the Hyatt, because the city was, and the state, were requiring that he have an option. Only would make sense before you convey public benefits to a developer to build something, that he would have an option on the site. On the other hand, Penn Central said, we want to see that the city is going to commit and the state is going to commit to this tax abatement, which was a brand new thing and had never been done before by the city or state. They conjured up a whole economic development program precisely for the Hyatt and for the Trumps. And so they said, well, we want to see that before we give you an option. So no one noticed, but I had foiled the city, and I, going through the city records, I see the option. And it's signed only by Donald. There's no signature there from anybody from Penn Central. So I wrote that in the story, and I asked him about it, and he flipped out about it at the time and all the rest of it. But years later, when he writes The Art of the Deal, he not only admits that he did that, but brags about what a stroke of genius this was, to fraudulently convince the city of New York that he had an option that he didn't have.
Wow.
Now they were leaning over backwards to do anything. The Beam administration was leaning over. I can't be the only person who noticed it was unsigned, but I was, you know, it was, the city had to have noticed, but they had just decided they were going to do this anyway. So, yeah, there was an option in the file signed by one of two parties. And he later cited this as an example of the art of the deal.
Hmm. And I wonder even if that was his idea. I mean, just so that people understand what the dynamic is here, is that the city, and I guess maybe the state, is willing to give a basically, you know, what we would consider like some type of like enterprise zone deal to Trump, but they needed to know that he had an option. He had the exclusive right right to build on this property that was owned by Penn, and Penn needed to know that he had access to the special abatements from the state or the city, so that they would get into business with him because they wanted to get a payoff. And I wonder if it was his idea to put in just his, a document with just his signature, or if somebody in the city said to him, just put the document in, don't worry, we can, you know, if the document's there, we can always say some clerk overlooked it. You know, I wonder if it was his idea, but maybe we'll never know on that
accord. I don't think we'll know. Maybe it was Fred's idea. Who knows?
All right, lastly, Wayne, give me just a sense of like what you think. You were a perhaps one of the premier muckraking reporters in New York City for decades. Give me your sense of what kind of job the media has done in terms of revealing Trump, and what might be, I mean, you know, from whence that came. I mean, because I think for a long time people just weren't taking him seriously.
Yeah, but, you know, I think print has done a reasonably good job. The Times has had four front page stories, all of which, including the one that ran on the women, I thought were pretty good stories. Some of them exceptionally good stories. Charlie Bagley did that story about the employees at Mar-a-Lago and how few of them were locals, and most were Romanians, and an excellent story. And McIntyre did this story recently about Trump Soho that built off of some of the things I'd written back in 2011, but did just an extraordinary job, revealing, for example, that, and this is a project that Ivanka and Donald Jr. and Eric all have an interest in. And as I said in my story in 2011, Ivanka had said, told depositors and was so involved in the campaign to promote it that she'd said 60% of the units had been sold, when at that very time they had filed a report with the state attorney general saying that only 14% of the units had been sold. Mm-hmm. And so Cy Vance, according to McIntyre's story in the Times, was looking into whether or not the depositors had been fraudulently induced into making their investments in these units. And astonishingly, I have no idea why this isn't a big, big story, because astonishingly, on the front page of the New York Times, we learned that that Trump then settled with the depositors, paid millions of dollars to them, and part of the settlement explicitly said that they could not cooperate with the Manhattan district attorney in his criminal investigation. So it's official hush money. And yet,
can you do that? Can you do that? Can you pay?
I've never heard of anybody doing
it. Isn't that the definition of obstruction of justice? I mean,
I would agree with you, Sam. It's just an alarming story. I mean, I urge everybody that's listening to go back and read McIntyre's story in the Times. It's incredible. And what's even more incredible is it's never been mentioned on any cable news show. None of the Times stories or Harrell's stories in the Washington Post, these are the two best papers in the United States. O'Harrell did an extraordinarily good story about the Taj and how Trump lied under, now that's my word, I don't think he uses that word, but certainly testified before the Casino Control Commission that he would never use any junk bonds to finance the Taj. Got the approval and then proceeded to use junk bonds to finance the whole thing.
Wow.
And these stories go by the board. So the great failing is that the canvas on which presidential campaigns occur is the TV screen. And I've never seen a greater failure by broadcast journalists. The broadcast journalists have been living off of the print press in every presidential election that I've ever seen. And this time they created a new set of rules, and they just, usually you would have these panels with the reporter on it and other people to discuss the story. Instead, these stories get no airtime. They get absolutely no airtime. Now, and these are networks that are making fortunes
right
off of covering the Trump campaign and who are giving him endless amount of airtime, but they won't give any airtime to legitimate stories that unveil what his real business practices are. And I think that's the great failing of broadcast journalists. Now, we used to actually have, just think back to 2012, Mike Isikoff, a great investigative reporter, was working for NBC, MSNBC, and he was doing investigative stories that were television investigative stories day after day and week after week. Linda Myers, where they fired both of them, right? And so they don't even try to pretend, the television outlets, to generate their own investigative reporting, and they ignore all the good investigative reporting that's occurring, some of which can be quite sexy.
Yeah, paying off people not to cooperate with a criminal investigation seems to me like that just seems.
Like 2 days after, McIntyre's story ran, Anderson Cooper has this interview on CNN with the whole family. Now, these are not Ted Cruz's 8-year-olds. All right? They try to treat Ivanka as a grown woman. She's like the second most influential manager of the Trump organization. She's right on the stage, and all they ask is, do you love your papa? You know, she's a grown-up woman. She's a businesswoman. She's the one who misrepresented the, you know, completely misstated the sale of the apartments. Donald Jr. did, too. They're sitting right there on the stage. They have a piece of the action themselves individually. They don't ask Trump about it. They don't ask Trump's children about it. It's like this is forbidden terrain.
I wonder if it's not just a question of, like, sort of in the narrative arc that they're creating, they got to build them up first before they introduce this stuff. But I hope to get to that second act, frankly.
Yeah, well, we all do. But then, you know, if it's all done to promote, what I wrote in the new chapter to the book is, I'm a sports nut, all right? I watch a great deal of sports. What's really happened is that there is no separation that I can see now between sports reporting and news reporting on the networks. You know, it is the job of every sports reporter to portray a clash between the two worst teams in the National Football League as a clash of titans.
Right.
You know, you got to promote every game. I mean, we've seen them promote every primary endlessly, every caucus endlessly. So it's, you know, it's you have to promote the game is the whole thing that goes on with sports reporting. And I think that's what's gone on with news reporting now. It's not like they never ask Trump a tough question. They do. That's all part of the game. But it's that they have to keep the game intensely competitive. If this becomes, imagine, Sam, that
right.
That Hillary is up by 13 points nationally and winning well in all of the swing states 2 months out of the election. How's that going to affect ratings? You know, so everything has to be keyed now, just like it is with sports promotion. It has to be keyed to promoting the race. And that includes, if you're trying to make a race, then you can't say too much about the guy who may be coming in dead last.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know how conscious this is, but look, you can look at, what Moonves said from CBS about what a bonanza this has been. And it's just become, I always thought, I mean, it's not like a new revelation that ratings matter to producers of television news, but I didn't think it was the only thing that mattered.
Yeah.
Appears to be the case.
I think you're right about that. I think that's a fascinating insight. Wayne Barrett, we will put a link to the updated version of your book, Trump, The Greatest Show on Earth. Thanks so much for your time today. A real pleasure. Great to talk to you again.